Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 24th of March. President Barack Obama wrote an op-ed piece that appeared in 30 newspapers all around the world yesterday. This in anticipation of the G20 summit, which will take place very soon and will deal with the world's economic situation. He wrote, trillions of dollars have been lost, banks have stopped lending, and tens of millions will lose their jobs across the globe. The prosperity of every nation has been endangered, along with the stability of governments and the survival of people in the most vulnerable parts of the world. And once and for all, we have learned that the success of the American economy is inextricably linked to the global economy. There is no line between action that restores growth within our borders and action that supports it beyond. This hour of the program, we'll be talking about that meeting and about America's place in the global economy and America's responsibility for perhaps initiating this global economic crisis. We'll have as our guest Mr. David Rothkopf. He's a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and has written Running the World, The Inside Story of the NSC and The Architects of American Power. He has published many articles on America's role in the world and directed the efforts of the Carnegie Economic Strategy Roundtable. His most recent book is Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making, which examines the power of global elites, how they're shaping globalization and being shaped by it. He served as Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade Policy in the Clinton administration, and he is with us the first hour of our program today. We'll be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation or send an email if you'd like, and that address is talk@wpr.org. David Rothkopf, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure.
Was it unusual for the president to send this op-ed that appeared in papers all over the world?
Well, it's a little unusual. It doesn't happen that often, but I think you see the Obama administration really trying all forms of outreach. You know, it's a little unusual for a president to appear on the Jay Leno show, too. I think
Right. They
see that this is such a serious crisis that they need to drum up support. And one of the things that they're trying to do is sort of pull the filter of the Washington press corps out of the equation and speak directly to audiences in the U.S. and around the world.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, as the G20 begins here, tell me the extent of the global economic crisis. What countries are being particularly affected? Is it a worldwide event? And how is it manifesting itself, David?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a worldwide event. $50 trillion of asset value has been wiped off the books. The International Labor Organization has estimated that 50 million jobs will be lost worldwide. In Latin America alone, something like 15 to 20 million people who had sort of climbed out of poverty will be pushed back into it. And needless to say, when you've got economic effects like that, they produce political and social and security problems. And so, you know, you've got governments falling in Iceland. You've got protests in the street from Greece to China. You've got real concerns about some stability of some governments in Eastern Europe. In Pakistan, there's a serious, you know, financial dimension to the leadership crisis they're going through. And so on. So, mm-hmm. You know, I think we've seen an economic tsunami, but it's bound to produce repercussions that are that touch the political world and affect our national security as well as stability around the world.
The president said in his letter, I know that Americans bear our share of responsibility for the mess that we all face. Is it important for us to examine what responsibility we do bear here and for other nations to do the same so we can get ourselves out of the mess?
Well, I mean, you know, I think reflection is a good thing. I think recognizing the different points of culpability in the system, whether it's greed on Wall Street or failed oversight in Washington or a political system that depends too much on money from the people who've got it, so that, you know, the overseers, for instance, of financial markets depended primarily on people in the financial markets for the donations that made their campaigns possible. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there is also a kind of component of hubris on the part of the architects of the international financial system who said, you don't need to regulate us. What we are doing is going to make the world safer. We understand the consequences of the things we're doing. And all of those things, of course, were proven wrong. And governments around the world played a role in either not getting together to look into the risks more or managing their own accounts better and so on. And so, you know, that's probably a worthwhile spiritual exercise to go and examine ourselves and who's wrong and so forth. But we're in a crisis, and the first thing we need to do is to stop the bleeding. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing we need to do is figure out how we restore growth in this country again. And I think one of the best ways to get to that is to get past the blame game as quickly as we can.
Mm-hmm. And when you say restore growth, can you talk about what growth we need?
Well, I mean, you know, if we're losing 600,000 jobs a month, the 600,000 people who lost their jobs every month are saying, well, how about enough growth so that I've got a job again? We also are spending trillions and trillions of dollars. And the only way that, you know, the Obama administration foresees reducing the deficit by half and starting to control the deficit in out years is, you know, getting back to 2.5-3% growth here in the United States and restoring global growth. I mean, international trade, according to a report out yesterday from the World Trade Organization, is down 9% this year. Hmm. That's the worst collapse in global trade since the Second World War. And so unless that starts back up, people aren't buying products, people aren't, working along the supply chain. And so, you know, there is almost no place that you can think of in the global economy that doesn't require a jump start right now.
That figure that you gave of the number of people around the world who are losing their jobs is incredibly breathtaking. And you think of the ripple effects of all of that, the money they don't have to buy products, the money they don't have to keep their families afloat or themselves afloat, the jobs that don't exist. It's just, it's darn depressing.
I think it's worse than that. You know, in the whole world, you know, there's 6 billion people in the world. There are only, say, 2 billion people that have any kind of, you know, sustainable employment. Half the people in the world are living on $2 a day. So say you're in a family and both people are working, and maybe you're lucky, you're living in Bangladesh and you're making $5 a day. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden your income falls by 40%. So now you're living on $3 a day, you and your kids. Well, it's not a question of employment or unemployment. In that case, it's a question of who gets food,
right?
Who gets medicine, who goes to school. And while that may seem incredibly remote for the average American, that's really the issue for half the people on the planet Earth. So, they consider some of the problems we're having to be, you know, luxuries practically.
Mm-hmm. The president in that op-ed said that the G20 should quickly deploy resources to stabilize emerging markets. Do you think that the United States has done enough and done it in the right way in this regard? And is the G20 kind of behind the times here in deploying the resources that are needed?
Well, look, you know, I think there's a rule of thumb, in international affairs, which is, you know, you get leadership in inverse proportion to the number of leaders who actually go into the room. And, you know, the G20, we have not even 20 delegations, there are 26 delegations. And it's really, really hard to get everybody on the same page. And that's why I think you're going to have this meeting next week in which there will be an agreement perhaps on recapitalizing the IMF or giving some money to the World Bank, and then there are going to be a bunch of principles. But, you know, there won't be agreement on whether, you know, countries should embrace big stimulus packages, because the Europeans don't think that countries should, and the U.S. you know, has a different point of view. There won't be agreement on big, you know, creating new regulatory mechanisms internationally because nobody wants to cede sovereignty to some supranational regulatory mechanism. There won't be agreement on you know, the Chinese and Russians in the past 2 days have both proposed a new reserve currency because they don't think we should rely so much on the dollar. Clearly, there's going to be a lot of, you know, dispute on that. And so, you know, the G20 is, you know, got a lot on its shoulders, but is going to deliver much, much less than people had hoped. And, you know, part of that's an adjustment. You know, it used to be the G8 used to do these things, and these were all sort of like-minded countries. The real breakthrough that took place at the end of last year is that the emerging countries, which play such a vital role in the global economy now, were invited into the equation. The problem is nobody wanted to say, well, Italy, you're no longer invited, Canada, you're no longer invited, and so forth. And so we're in a transitional period, and the G20 is kind of unwieldy. Ultimately, we're going to end up with something, 13 or 14 countries that include Russia, India, Brazil, China, and the developed countries. But problem is we're in a transitional period and a moment of big crisis when we need the group, and that's one of the reasons we've got this sort of policy bottleneck there.
Mm-hmm. David, what would it mean for us, and do you see this as a possibility to have a new reserve currency?
Well, I don't see it as a near-term possibility, but, you know, 40 years ago, you probably wouldn't have said people would go off the gold standard completely, and 20 years ago, you would have doubted whether the euro might emerge as a real reserve currency in the world, and you know, I don't think anybody would have predicted 25 years ago that there would be more money and value and derivatives out in the world marketplace than there were in all the currencies of the world added up. So things like that do happen. If it does happen, and you know, the consequences for the United States could be quite great. The dollar weakens. We are able to buy less. There are inflationary pressures. The Federal Reserve, you know, fights this by increasing interest rates, makes it harder to borrow money, makes it harder to grow. There are all sorts of things that a weakened U.S. currency could do, and you know, another set of them have to do with who out there in the rest of the world might have an advantage in the new system. That could give them more power. You know, we've seen a lot of sort of the capital clout that once resided on Wall Street move to other places. The Chinese now are the ones with $2 trillion in the bank. They're the ones in the best position to weather the storm and to help out other countries they want to help out. And we're the ones that are in debt. So there may very well be something much bigger here that's shifting. We're not going to stop being the world's most powerful nation for a long time, but there are a lot of other countries that are gaining, and we're losing.
So China could become much more of a powerhouse.
I think it's inevitable that China becomes much more of a powerhouse. Even right now, in the midst of this crisis, the best-performing economy in the world is China. If it grows at 6.5%, that's a problem for the Chinese because of how many people they've got there and so forth. But it's still, you know, way above a world that may contract at 0.5% this year. They've got the cash to weather the storm. They've got all sorts of opportunity being created within their economy. And right now, this is also the first crisis where the undisputed G2 of the world, the two most important players, are the U.S. and China. And we face this new challenge of having our biggest commercial partner also be a geopolitical rival. That hasn't historically been the case for us. Our biggest partners have been our closest friends. And that's going to be quite a challenge.
Mm-hmm. So before we take phone calls, I feel pretty gloomy about everything after putting it in a, you think things are bad here and you put it in a world perspective and you feel even gloomier. Risk of being too simplistic here, but what the heck is the way out of all of this?
Well, first of all, economies do tend to repair themselves. I mean, you know, you do get prices down to a certain point where people see that there's values. You had first-time home buying up 5% last month. That's kind of impressive. You know, obviously you want to see that sustained over some time. There are some parts of the world where demand may be bottoming out. One of them is China, because they do have these massive reserves that enable them to stimulate the economy where they need it. If demand bottoms out there and then starts coming back up, commodity prices will start coming back up a little bit. That'll help emerging markets around the world from continuing to sort of spiral downward. That can have a stabilizing effect. You know, at the if what Geithner has done yesterday and all these other measures restore a little bit of confidence in the market and lending comes back a little bit, you could actually see the end of this year, more likely the beginning of next year, some resurgence of growth. And so I don't, you know, I mean, don't go out on the ledge right now. I think, okay. we will recover from this crisis. I think the more interesting question is, what does the world look like on the other side of the crisis? Hmm. You know, what are the new geopolitical relationships? You know, what are the industries that lead the way out? Is it, you know, green growth, I think, is going to play a big role in it. The auto industry is going to look a lot different. The financial services industry is going to look a lot different. The healthcare industry is going to look a lot different. One of the, you know, interesting challenges that would face you if you were a CEO is, you know, what's my place in this new world? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I mean, that's challenging, but it's not as depressing. And at this hour of the morning, I certainly think you owe it to your listeners to get them off the ledge as well.
Thank you, David. We're going to welcome phone calls, and here is our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The president, of course, is speaking tonight on the economy and a few other issues he has on his plate, and we'll be covering that at 7 o'clock, NPR News special coverage of President Obama's primetime news conference. Robert Siegel will be your host, and the president will be talking about, as a press conference, you don't know exactly, but certainly he'll be looking at the G20 and the NATO summits, and he'll be talking about American International Group. What's their name now? They changed it, right? American International something or other. So that's coming up tonight. Coverage at 7 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for David. And for those of you just tuning in, our guest this hour on the Ideas Network is David Rothkopf. He's a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he has studied and written about the very areas that we're talking about. His most recent book is Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. And he's also the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the NSC and the Architects of American Power. Okay, let's go to phone calls. Laverne from Monroe is first. Hey, Laverne.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hello, David.
Hey.
I've been talking about derivatives now on public radio for 17 years, and I don't think that's going to do the problem. And I don't think hedge fund dealers worldwide are going to solve the problem either. I have 59 letters on the Obama blog. This is Mr. Geithner is talking about is this infrastructure banking. It's hard to pronounce. It's all he's going to do is make a bigger hedge fund dealer, kind of to replace AIG, and that's what caused the problem in the first place. I think in the end, the G20 is going to have more constructive ideas than what President Obama is going to suggest tonight. And I think you got to get back to what is real money, and you got to get back to what is good commercial banks do, not these here hedge fund dealers, because I think that's the people that ruined the whole thing.
David?
Well, look, I mean, I think common sense, took a holiday on Wall Street for the past 20 years, and one of the sort of most fundamental breakdowns was an argument that by creating all these derivative instruments and allowing people to sort of sell off risk to people who wanted to buy it, we were somehow making the system safer. Now, 25 years into that process, with hundreds of trillions of dollars in derivatives out there where counterparties are unknown and risk is unknown, the system is sitting on, kegs and kegs of dynamite. We've seen one example as it pertained to to housing markets in the United States. There are other possibilities out there. And the question is what to do about it. And one thing that the G20 will look at has to do with regulation and transparency. And one idea that Larry Summers, the president's chief economic advisor, has talked about, and actually on a Sunday talk show I think a week ago, said they would be pursuing, is the idea of creating an exchange for derivatives where these transactions would take place in a more transparent way. You'd see who the other parties were. There would be regulations. And I think that'll go a long way towards taking some of the risk that comes from the opacity of these markets out and restoring some stability. What Geithner did yesterday was a partial measure. The various steps to support mortgage borrowers, another partial measure, creating derivatives market, another partial measure, creating some kind of global coordination, another partial measure. It's going to take a lot of steps because it was a very complicated problem, and we're not there yet. But I do think there is a recognition that the formulas that were sold by Wall Street as gospel for 25 years are out the window, and they've lost a lot of credibility.
Mm-hmm. Could you give me an answer that I can understand here? Because this stuff gets complicated to me. But one of the thrusts of what we've been hearing from listeners, because we've talked about this for a long time and from some commentators, is whether or not you can trust the people who are charged with this massive overhaul, this massive project to get us out of this mess, who were, some have said, responsible for getting us a mess in the first place, and specifically referencing Geithner and Summers. Are these the guys to lift us up?
I don't know. They're the guys we got. I know these guys pretty well, and they're both really smart guys, and they're well-intentioned guys, and they're not the sort of sellouts to Wall Street that people have characterized them as. The team that's in place is almost identically the team that was in place in the Clinton administration. And if you'd asked anybody in the world the day after Clinton left office, was that a good team? They'd say, well, we had created 23 million jobs, biggest expansion in U.S. history, et cetera, balanced the budget, created a surplus. They'd say, yeah, that was a good team. But we also deregulated Wall Street, and we did a number of things that have had very negative consequences 10 years out. So, I doubt there's ever been a smarter team in office. I doubt that there have been teams that have come in with as much experience. But this is an entirely new situation. It requires new thinking. And I worry a little bit that too many of these people have been together for too long, because that's a formula for groupthink.
Mm-hmm.
That's a formula for we got it right, we can ignore the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And, groupthink is what got us into Iraq. And so I worry a little bit about that. But again, these are pretty early days, and I think doing the history book interpretation of the Obama administration ought to wait a while. Let's give them a year in office before we start evaluating whether they can cut it or not.
Okay, thanks, Laverne, for your call. Bill from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. I guess my main wonderment is we're having this financial disaster, and up to this point, people live by having more and possessing more and owning more, and I happen to be a psychotherapist and believe that that's not what's making anybody happy, and it's really relationships and people. I respect what your guest is saying about needing to feed the people of the world and to keep people employed and contributing to society, but can there come out of this or begin the tiny beginning somewhere of some rational perspective about what matters in the world and some belief that maybe owning everything and buying more is going to not be productive? And can we reach some kind of balance where we start to not just be consumers but human beings caring about each other and enjoying what we have?
Oh, I love your question, Bill. Can we just be good human beings, David?
Well, hasn't happened yet, but having said that, which is a little cynical, my sense is that I'm a big believer in progress. I think that things get better as we go forward. People live longer. They've got a higher quality of life. They're better educated. They're exposed to more things. They're less parochial. There's more interaction between them. People have more relationships. Using new new techniques and technologies, and they benefit from that. And you know, these kind of big adjustments, these kind of earthquakes, they're not just economic earthquakes; they're also social ones. And for the past 25 years, we've lived in a society where sort of the default that drove the social contract was, let's leave it to the markets. Let's let the markets decide. Mm-hmm. And part of that was the measure for your success was, let's see how much money you can make. Let's see how high up the, you know, and trees would grow to the sky. People would make billions and billions. And that was a sign that they were brilliant, that they were right, that they were successful, and so forth. And the gaps between the richest and the poorest grew more rapidly in the past 30 years than at any time in history. And the haves were living large, and the have-nots were not, whether it was, you know, worldwide or in Manhattan, where the ratio of the top fifth to the bottom fifth went from 99 to 1 to 90 to 1. Something was wrong, and I think people have come to be kind of distrustful of what got us there. The real question is, who's offering the alternative? You know, it gets back to that other question. What do things look like on the other side? And there are a lot of people out there that think, okay, well, let's just get this over with and we'll get back to what we were doing. And I hope that's not what happens, because what we were doing was creating a society nationally and internationally that was deeply divided, and that had its values upside down.
Well, let's talk more about the other side then, David. What would you like to see on the other side?
Well, I mean, you know, again, this is a complicated question, because you're kind of saying, you know, how should the rest of the world look, you know, from a year from now going forward, you know, and there are a lot of things. But I do think that, you know, one of the crucial questions is, how do you enforce the social contract in the global era? What, you know, what do people want from their governments? What do governments want from their people? What's the role of the public sector and the private sector? How do you achieve more balance? How do you fix social safety nets in our society so they're comparable to those, you know, in other societies around the world? Mm-hmm. And, you know, going forward, you know, I think that there are a lot of questions about how do we grow and what kind of jobs are we creating? And, you know, here's one area where the Obama administration has gotten it, I think, profoundly right. You know, we have to spend on education or we will fall behind the rest of the world. We have to fix the healthcare system, because whatever we're spending now, the $80 trillion gap in funding healthcare dwarfs these giant amounts that are being spent now. And we have to go and move towards a different energy paradigm for national security reasons, for climate change reasons, and for job creation reasons. Mm-hmm. And so if we can move to a focus on those things, we can reinvent the U.S. economy. They can be making something new and different and for the future in places like Detroit. And as it happens, those things can make the world safer and the climate can be protected. So, you know, there are some good things that could be brewing in all of this. We just, you know, we have to keep our eye on this idea of change.
Thank you, Bill, for your call. We have a couple lines open. They've been crowded. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we're talking about the global economy in anticipation of the G20 summit, which will take place next week, and President Obama's op-ed piece that appeared in 30-some newspapers around the world, also in anticipation of this summit. Rick is next. Did I give you the number? I can never remember. 800-486-8655. Rick from Mellon is next. Hi, Rick.
Hello, good morning. I'd like to briefly enlarge on caller Laverne's remarks on this market for derivatives that's being proposed by the Obama administration. I have heard part of the proposal for this is that any future losses of these hedge fund operators that invest in this fund would be guaranteed up to 95% of their possible losses by the federal taxpayer. And number two, I have heard that the Fed is starting to withdraw the money from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Commission, which is there to protect bank deposits of depositors in case of bank defaults. They're taking that money out of that fund in order to add to the American money supply, essentially to print money. I'd like to have your guesses, your guests' response to these two.
Well, the I think we're conflating two things here. Creating a market in derivatives, as I was referring to it earlier, is a broader question. It's about how do derivative instruments get traded in the future. The proposal that you were talking about, where hedge funds are insured, is the toxic asset proposal that was put forth yesterday by Tim Geithner, pertaining to an amount of toxic assets up to perhaps $1 trillion, where the idea is that private investors would come buy these assets now when they're at a low price, take some risk associated with them, but the U.S. would take most of the risk, and then the U.S. and the investors would share the upside. I think this is, you know, not a bad measure. I don't think it's a game changer, but it does, you know, it does remove one of the things that was an impediment to getting banks lending, and that's important because at the core of this all, there's a liquidity crisis. People don't, you know, banks don't lend, financial institutions don't put money out there, people can't invest, and the economy can't grow. As far as the other issue, you know, the Fed has taken some extraordinary measures to put additional cash into the system, almost over $1 trillion last week, and you know, there is a sense that, again, what they're trying to do is to ensure that the liquidity is there so that the growth can restart. There is some concern that this will lead to inflation down the road. In fact, you know, printing money is kind of the historically, you know, traditional path towards inflation. But, you know, in terms of moving money in or out of systems where people are relying on the federal government, we're nowhere near the point where anybody needs to worry about whether the federal government's going to live up to its guarantees. It certainly is. Even with all the debt that we've added, we're well within ratios of debt to GDP that work around the world. I'm kind of a fiscal hawk, and I think we ought to be a little bit more cautious about spending our money, and I think we ought to focus more on balancing the budget. But having said that, I don't think anybody needs to worry about the full faith and credit of the U.S. government because we're still in a pretty good position to cover our obligation.
Thanks for the call. Chris from Glendale, hi.
When I speak to working class people, I hear two beliefs, and these two beliefs I think are flawed. The first belief is that the gold standard would inherently be a good thing. And the second belief is that conspiracies exist. What's wrong with these two assertions?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, the gold standard is not going to come back. The size of the global economy is much too big, and the gold standard is, of course, completely artificial anyway because gold doesn't have any inherent value more than, you know, a promise of a government to meet an obligation. I think the latter has supplanted the gold standard simply because it makes more sense and it works better in sort of international financial markets that have vastly outstripped the old kind of commercial affairs that were supported by the gold standard. In terms of conspiracies, you know, I've been in the government. I wrote a book on the superclass, and, you know, everybody wants to believe that, you know, it's the guys going to Bilderberg or the people going to Davos or the World Jewish Conspiracy or the Freemasons or somebody has all the answers. If anything, this past crisis proves there's nobody who has all the answers. There's nobody who's got, you know, the power cornered. If there was any group that had, you know, hugely disproportionate power over the political system and over the way the world economy was going, it would be the people at the very top on Wall Street. They clearly didn't know what was going on or have the power to stop what was going on here. A friend of mine who was once a very senior official in the U.S. government said, if something happens in the United States government and one, you know, possibility is that it happened because there was a secret plan and another possibility is that it happened because of an accident, 999 times out of 1,000, it's because it was an accident. It's very, very, very hard to coordinate the interests of the super empowered. When those interests align, they're powerful. When they don't align, the conspiracy theories go up in smoke. I think we'd be better off not focusing on the conspiracies of people off in the ether or in secret boardrooms someplace, and not focusing on how we can bring back some distant past that can never be reclaimed. I think it'd be better to focus on what we can do right now to address the problems that are right in front of us, and particularly to address the ones that we have some control over.
And thanks for the call. Let's address, I keep in the back of my mind thinking about those tens of millions of people all over the world who have lost their jobs, and the hundreds of thousands who are losing jobs in America each month. What about the United States' response to that? And is there anything going on in other countries that we can learn from? That's a big part of all this, and people feel like their job could be next, and they're worried about it. And people who've lost their jobs are fairly lost. What's the best way of addressing this, David?
Well, I think ultimately, the stimulus is the kind of conclusion you're going to come to, which is the government goes and spends some money to create some jobs that help fill this gap, or does things that create demand that help create new jobs. So if all of a sudden we create a cap on, emissions and that incents and a price for carbon, and that incents people to go and seek other forms of energy, people who are selling greener energy or who are selling energy efficiency will see demand grow, and that'll create more jobs. There are other things that other countries are doing in this regard, whether some of them, Chinese are producing big infrastructure projects that hire a lot of things, or they're buying reserves of products so that, it can keep companies going. Or even in Singapore, I was talking to a Singaporean yesterday, and she told me that the government's policy is that they will pay up to 12% of the payroll of people to keep them on the job. So they're doing little, of payroll up to a certain amount, and salaries up to a certain amount. But essentially what they're doing is saying, don't fire people now. And we'll subsidize your, keeping them on. In all of these cases, though, what you see is a pattern, which is the market has stalled. The market acting on its own is actually going to shed jobs. And governments need to step in, play a bigger role, write the checks, and for the moment create the demand which employs people until the economies can restart.
David Rothkopf is our guest this hour. We're talking about the global economy in anticipation of the G20 summit taking place next week, and he is a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Our number, 800-486-8655. We'll return to your phone calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight at 7, National Public Radio will be covering President Barack Obama's news conference, and Robert Siegel will be your host, so a reminder that starting tonight here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Jeff from Winneconnie is next. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning.
Hello.
We have sweatshops all over the world that people are making a dollar an hour right now. It's just terrible. What the focus of the Obama people is to start, in Japan, India, to start unions there, have people come in and make sure that these people make a decent living wage so that they can live their lives, halfway decent. What's happening is the super rich people are not even from this country, like Onassis, that are setting up corporations over there and making money hand and foot. Now, what Obama's going to do is he's going to even that up a little bit, and I would like your guests to comment on that. Thank you.
All right, Jeff.
Well, I think the caller puts his, finger on an important point, which is that around the world, lots and lots of people are entering the global economy. New technologies in transportation and new technologies in communication make it possible to manufacture anything anywhere. And there are plenty of people in the world who work for very little money. And so labor costs overseas are a huge competitive advantage for those countries. And in some areas, we're just not going to reverse that. But the best cure, the best stabilizer in all of this would be for their standards of living to go up. Now the Obama administration's in no position to go and promote the development of unions overseas, except to the extent that it can work through the International Labor Organization and work with other governments to ensure that unions have rights to develop overseas, and I'm sure that they will be doing that. But this is going to be a slow process, and there are going to be dislocations. I think one of the key things we have to ask as a country is, how do we deal with the dislocations? How do we take care of people here who used to have a job that manufactured something, mm-hmm. that literally we can't compete anymore for that job? And I'll tell you an interesting, very kind of a brief story. I was in Sweden. I was talking to a guy who was a former Swedish finance minister, and he said, we in this country are very pro-free trade, and you in the United States have started to pull back from free trade, and we in this country have very, very strong unions. And so what happens as a result of that is that the people who work here aren't afraid if jobs, company goes. Like the Swedes just this week said no to Saab. They're not going to bail them out. Why aren't they afraid? Because they know the social safety net is there. They know they're getting health care. They know they'll get education. They're not going to be thrown out in the street as a result of this crisis. And he said an interesting thing, which is very counterintuitive in the United States. He said, your problem isn't that unions are too strong in the United States. He said, your problem is that unions are too weak, and that you haven't built the social safety net that allows a country to deal with the inevitable dislocations that come from globalization.
Hmm. Very interesting. All right, let's go to Chris from Gurnee. Hi, Chris.
Hi, this is a very interesting conversation, and actually I think this plays into Sweden, because I believe it was a guest on NPR I heard last week, 10 Ideas That Have to Die, something like that, and he was saying that in some place, I think it was Sweden, it was one of the Norwegian countries up there, they actually pay stay-at-home mothers to stay home and take care of their children. And I was thinking here, that would solve many different problems. I personally am a stay-at-home mom. I have 3 degrees, and I'm choosing to stay home with my children. And our family's really taken a hit from that. But, we've managed it. And I think that it would open up a lot of opportunities for families who are strapped financially, who have elders to care for, who have small children, and who don't necessarily want to go to work but have to.
David.
Well, I think it's an interesting point, and I think that there are clearly a lot of people who provide value in the economy who are not compensated for that value in traditional ways. And, as one rethinks the social contract, one may rethink whether or not the government has responsibility to pay for people to do this short-term or long-term, or whether special provisions can be made regarding some things like health care to ensure that when somebody leaves and goes to make a choice like this, they're protected regarding that kind of thing. Here's a problem we've got, though. Right now, the United States is $11-12 trillion of debt. It's going to go up by trillions and trillions of dollars over the next several years till it hits $15 or $16 or $17 trillion of debt. And we have this ballooning expense coming in terms of healthcare, retirement healthcare in the United States, which is unfunded. And even with growth in our economy, we're going to have to make some hard choices. So while a lot of these ideas seem like good ideas, a real question that we're going to have to face is, what can we afford? And maybe the answer is, well, we have a military that, we spend more on defense in the United States than every other country in the world added up together. And, we thought that's been the key to our security. Well, maybe we're going to have to come to the conclusion that the key to our security is using those resources to ensure economic vitality and social stability at home, and that we're going to have to be less interventive overseas, and we're going to have to rely more on collaboration with our partners overseas. But we're entering an era of hard choices, unlike any preceding era in the U.S. since perhaps the 19th century. We're used to being able to have everything we want as a country, just as many Americans are as families, and we're going to have to experience something new, which is, you know, saying no.
Thanks, Chris, so much for your call. Let's go to Christopher from Madison. Hi, Christopher.
Hello. I understand that it was the run-up in oil prices last year that was the match that got this financial crisis going. And we have a looming peak oil coming, and that's going to undermine everything. I wonder what you say to that.
Well, there were, first of all, you know, anybody who says here's the one thing that caused what we're in right now is and I'm not saying you did this intentionally, but it is oversimplifying. I mean, there were fundamental structural flaws in the way that we were financing housing in the United States. There were major flaws in the way that the risk associated with the mortgage securities was being distributed. There were a whole host of flaws with the way financial institutions were rated and how markets responded to that, how they were regulated. So all these things played a big role. But, you know, taking the issue of oil, we have to, you know, break this addiction and move to a new paradigm in terms of energy. And we have to do it for three reasons. We have to do it because, you know, the weight of the science says that we're damaging the climate and that it's going to take real substantial progress on this front fast in order to get that back under control, or we're going to deal with a whole host of new issues worldwide associated with global warming. We also find ourselves embroiled in, you know, dangerous escalating conflicts in a Middle East that could be soon much more dangerous if Iran proceeds with its nuclear program and it triggers a nuclear arms race throughout the Middle East. There is only one solution to our problems in the Middle East long term, and that is being less dependent on the Middle East. And the reason we care about that part of the world is oil, and the less we care about oil, the less we're going to be drawn into that. And so we need to find other sources of energy, either from stable, reliable places elsewhere, better yet, from right here in the United States. And finally, there's an economic reason to pursue a different kind of energy portfolio in the United States, and that is that it'll create jobs right here, it'll create better jobs, and it'll also sort of fuel the kind of innovation that has made the United States a leader in sort of past phases of history. But, you know, it's worth remembering that 100 years ago, the primary source of energy in the United States was timber, and, you know, in other words, firewood. And that, you know, we saw the rise of oil, along with it, an enormous rise in the use of coal. And periodically, those patterns change, and the things that we think are the way the world will always be, they don't hold true. Mm-hmm. And I think we're coming to the end of a chapter here. Though, you know, we'll be using oil for 20, 30, 40 years, but less and less and less. And there will be more and more urgency to finding alternatives and being more efficient.
Hmm. I keep thinking about that other side that you've mentioned a couple times, and I hope we get there okay. But there's something appealing about it too, isn't there?
Well, sure. I mean, yeah. You know, look, we can't go and take a referendum and say, let's not have a crisis. We're in a crisis. Mm-hmm. So given that we're in a crisis, the choice for us is, you know, put our heads down between our knees and hope it turns out okay, or try to figure out what's going to happen next and position ourselves to take advantage of that opportunity. You know, crises like this are where, you know, great fortunes are created, where new businesses are created. This is where the creative destruction of capitalism happens. People say, well, the past is wiped away. What can I do that's new and more responsive to tomorrow? And so, you know, I don't mean to sound like a Pollyanna, but there are oceans of opportunity in this if we see them and seize them. And I think that's, you know, that's something not to lose sight of.
Mm-hmm. 1 minute left. Let's go to one more phone call. Steve from Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hi. I'll try to be quick.
Okay.
My question is, previous crises, which I didn't live through, Depression, World War II, I heard a lot about people being asked, average citizens and workers being asked to do a lot. I don't hear that now. In the modern global world, is it impossible now? Do we just need experts to fix things, or can average workers do something?
Well, God help us if we just need experts. I think if this crisis has proven one thing, it's the experts are you know, don't know what they're talking about very often. You hit upon a really important point, and sacrifice is going to be key to allowing us to direct the assets that we do have to the areas that are most important, whether that's being more efficient in the way that you use energy, or whether it's saving a little bit, or whether it's you know, consuming a little less here so, you know, it can be invested in something that's better for your family there. That's absolutely critical. And I think President Obama is doing the country a disservice by not being more direct and saying, look, we need you to do this. We need you to sacrifice. Here's how we're going to get through this together. And I mean, he mentions this periodically. I give him credit for that. But I think he can do more.
Mm-hmm. David, thank you so much. It was a great hour. Thanks.
My pleasure.
David Rothkopf, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in the fair city of Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then a really interesting show that features students in history and art and putting books together. All of that's coming up, so stay with us.